In Central Station at last, they found conditions almost as bad. The lights dimmed, went out, came on again for a while as some auxiliary circuit took hold. Outside the watertight door on the lower side, the water began to rise, spouting through the cracks around the edges and shooting like a hose through an air test opening. Delano could hear the pleas and cries of the men trapped on the other side, and he thought with awe of the decision Lieutenant Commander J.S. Harper, the damage control officer, had to make. Let the men drown or open the door and risk the ship as well as the people now in Central Station. The door stayed closed. Delano suggested to Harper that he and his men might be more useful topside. For the moment, Harper didn't even have time to answer. He was desperately trying to keep in touch with the rest of the ship and direct the counter-flooding that might save it, but all the circuits were dead. The counter-flooding was done anyhow. Lieutenant Claude V. Ricketts had once been damage control officer and liked to discuss with other young officers what should be done in just this kind of situation. More or less as skull practice, they had worked out a plan among themselves. Now Ricketts began counter-flooding on his own hook, helped along by bosun's mate Billingsley, who knew how to work the knobs and valves. The West Virginia swung slowly back to starboard and settled into the harbor mud on an even keel. There was no time for counter-flooding on the Oklahoma, lying ahead of the West Virginia and outboard of the Maryland. Lying directly across from the southeast lock, she got three torpedoes right away, then another two as she heeled to port. Curiously, many of the men weren't even aware of the torpedoes. Seaman George Murphy only heard the loudspeaker say something about air attack and assumed the explosions were bombs. Along with hundreds of other men who had no air defense stations, he now trooped down to the third deck, where he would be protected by the armor plate that covered the deck above. Seaman Stephen Young never thought of torpedoes either, and he was even relieved when the water surged into the port side of No. 4 turret powder handling room. He assumed that someone was finally counter-flooding on that side to offset bomb damage to starboard. The water rose, the emergency lights went out, the list increased. Now everything was breaking loose. Big 1,000-pound shells rumbled across the handling rooms, sweeping men before them. 8-foot reels of steel towing cable rolled across the second deck, blocking the ladder's topside. The door of the drug room swung open, and Seaman Murphy watched hundreds of bottles cascade over a couple of seamen hurrying down a passageway. The boys slipped and rolled through the broken glass, jumped up and ran on. On the few remaining ladders, men battled grimly to get to the main deck. It was a regular log jam on the ladder to S Division compartment, just a few steps from open air. Every time something exploded outside, men would surge down the ladder, meeting head-on another crowd that surged up. Soon it was impossible to move in either direction. Seaman Murphy gave up even trying. He stood off to the side, one foot on deck, the other on the corridor wall, the only way he could now keep his footing. Yeoman L.L. Curry had a better way out. He and some mates were still in the machine shop on third deck amidships when the list reached 60 degrees. Someone spied an exhaust ventilator leading all the way to the deck, and one by one the men crawled up. As they reached fresh air, an officer ran over and tried to shoo them back inside, where they would be safe from bomb splinters. That was the big danger, he explained. A battleship couldn't turn over. Several hundred yards ahead of the Oklahoma, and moored alone at the southern end of Battleship Row, the California caught her first torpedo at 8:05. Yeoman Durrell Connor watched it come from his station in the flag communications office. He slammed the porthole shut as it struck the ship directly beneath him. Another crashed home farther aft. There might as well have been more. The California was wide open. She was due for inspection Monday, and the covers had been taken off 6 of the manholes leading to her double bottom. A dozen more of these covers had been loosened. The water poured in and surged freely through the ship. It swept into the ruptured fuel tanks, contaminating the oil, knocking out the power plant right away. It swirled into the forward air compressor station, where machinist's mate Robert Scott was trying to feed air to the 5-inch guns. The other men cleared out, calling Scott to come with them. He yelled back, "This is my station. I'll stay here and give them air as long as the guns are going." They closed the watertight door and let him have his way. With the power gone, men desperately tried to do by hand the tasks that were meant for machines. Yeoman Connor joined a long chain of men passing powder and shells up from an ammunition room far below. Stifling fumes from the ruptured fuel tanks made their work harder, and word spread that the ship was under gas attack. At the wounded collecting station in the crew's reception room, pharmacist's mate William Lynch smashed open lockers in a vain search for morphine. Near the communications office, a man knelt in prayer under a ladder. Numb to the chaos around him, another absently sat at a desk typing, "Now is the time for all good men." Around the harbor, nobody noticed the California's troubles. All eyes were glued on the Oklahoma. From his bungalow on Ford Island, Chief Albert Molter watched her gradually roll over on her side, slowly and stately, as if she were tired and wanted to rest. She kept rolling until her mast and superstructure jammed in the mud, leaving her bottom up, a huge dead whale lying in the water. Only 8 minutes had passed since the first torpedo hit. On the Maryland, electrician's mate Harold North recalled how everyone had cursed on Friday when the Oklahoma tied up alongside, shutting off what air there was at night. Inside the Oklahoma, men were giving it one more try. Storekeeper Terry Armstrong found himself alone in a small compartment on the second deck. As it slowly filled with water, he dived down, groped for the porthole, squirmed through to safety. Seaman Malcolm McCleary escaped through a washroom porthole the same way. Nearby, Lieutenant J.G. Aloysius Schmidt, the Catholic chaplain, started out too. But a breviary in his hip pocket caught on the combing. As he backed into the compartment again to take it out, several men started forward. Chaplain Schmidt had no more time to spend on himself. He pushed three, possibly four of the others through before the water closed over the compartment. Some men weren't even close to life as they knew it, but were still alive nevertheless. They found themselves gasping, swimming, trying to orient themselves to an upside-down world in the air pockets that formed as the ship rolled over. 17-year-old seaman Willard Beale fought back the water that poured into the steering engine room. Seaman George Murphy splashed about the operating room of the ship's dispensary, wondering what part of the ship had a tile ceiling, never dreaming he was looking up at the floor. Topside, the men had it easier. As the ship slowly turned turtle, most of the men simply climbed over the starboard side and walked with the roll, finally ending up on the bottom. When and how they got off was pretty much a matter of personal choice. Some started swinging hand over hand along the lines that tied the ship to the Maryland, but as she rolled, these snapped, and the men were pitched into the water between the two ships. Seaman Tom Armstrong dived off on this side. His watch stopped at 8:10. Tom's brother Pat jumped off from the outboard side. Their third brother Terry was already in the water after squeezing through the porthole on the second deck. Marine Gunnery Sergeant Lou Wares slid down a line and almost drowned when someone used him as a stepladder to climb into a launch. His friend Sergeant Norman Currier coolly walked along the side of the ship to the bow, hailed a passing boat, and stepped into it without getting a foot wet. Ensign Bill Ingram climbed onto the high side just as the yardarm touched the water. He stripped to his shorts and slid down the bottom of the ship. As Ingram hit the water, the Arizona blew up. Afterward, men said a bomb went right down her stack, but later examination showed even the wire screen across the funnel top still intact. It seems more likely the bomb landed alongside the second turret, crashed through the forecastle, and set off the forward magazines. In any case, a huge ball of fire and smoke mushroomed 500 feet into the air. There wasn't so much noise, most of the men say it was more a whoom than a bang, but the concussion was terrific. It stalled the motor of aviation ordnanceman Herrand Quisdorf's pickup truck as he drove along Ford Island. It hurled Chief Albert Molter against the pipe banister of his basement stairs. It knocked everyone flat on Fireman Stanley H. Rabe's water barge. It blew Gunner Kerry Garnett and dozens of other men off the Nevada. Commander Casson Young off the Vestal. Ensign Vance Fowler off the West Virginia. Far above, Commander Fuchida's bomber trembled like a leaf. On the fleet landing at Mary's Point, a Navy captain wrung his hands and sobbed that it just couldn't be true. On the Arizona, hundreds of men were cut down in a single searing flash. Inside the port anti-aircraft director, one fire control man simply vanished. The only place he could have gone was through the narrow rangefinder slot. On the bridge, Rear Admiral Isaac C. Kidd and Captain Franklin Van Valkenburg were instantly killed. On the second deck, the entire ship's band was wiped out. Over 1,000 men were gone. Incredibly, some still lived. Major Alan Shapley of the Marine Detachment was blown out of the foremast and well clear of the ship. Though partly paralyzed, he swam to Ford Island, detouring to help two shipmates along the way. Radioman Glenn Lane was blown off the quarterdeck and found himself swimming in water thick with oil. He looked back at the Arizona and couldn't see a sign of life.